And welcome to our next feature session on adolescent vaccines. My name is Rana Haji. I'm with the Division of Bacterial Diseases at the Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at CDC. And I have to read the disclosure first. So. CDC, our planners and our presenters wish to disclose that they have no financial interests or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. Presentations will not include any discussion of the unlabeled use of a product or a product under investigational use, with the exception of Dr. Markowitz, who will discuss the bivalent HPV vaccine series, which is under review by the FDA, but is not currently licensed in the US. So with that, it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, who will be speaking on the bacterial vaccine preventable diseases for adolescents. And this is Dr. Amanda Cohen. Amanda is a medical epidemiologist in the meningitis and vaccine preventable diseases branch in the Division of Bacterial Diseases. Since 2006, she has been the CDC lead for the ACIP meningococcal vaccines working group. And she has also been a principal investigator for ongoing vaccine effectiveness studies for adolescent pertussis and meningococcal vaccines. So, Melinda, Amanda.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. This morning, I'm going to be talking about two very different diseases, meningococcal disease and pertussis. And I'm actually going to be bringing up more questions than giving you answers, but hopefully I'll be able to provide some context for how we're going to answer several of these questions in the next couple of years. And these are questions I know you guys are getting every day. So we'll first take a look at the epidemiology and transmission characteristics of these diseases. Then we'll talk about these adolescent vaccines and their properties in immunogenicity. Then we'll talk about the ACIP recommendations for these vaccines and set the stage for the challenges we still face and the evolving strategy we're using these vaccines in order to maximize prevention of these diseases. So we've all seen the graph of these cases of reported pertussis disease that show a steep decline in the 1990s until it peaked in 2004 and 2005. Since then, the number of reported pertussis cases has come down, but there are still more cases of pertussis than there were prior to the 2004 and 2005 peak. So there's a presentation at 11 today looking at the early impact of Tdap on this decrease, so I'm not going to talk about this in particular right now. On the other hand, rates of meningococcal disease have drastically declined since the peak in the late 1990s. This decrease in incidence is lasting longer than typical cycles of disease that we've observed in the US. The decrease began well before conjugate vaccine introduction, and we don't really understand the reasons for this decrease, but we don't think that this is an impact of vaccine at this time. So these next two slides illustrate the similar disease patterns of meningococcal disease and pertussis. Cases occur in all age groups, but there are peaks in disease among infants less than 1 year old and among adolescents. Similarly, we see pertussis reported in all age groups. Clearly, vaccine strategies targeting only adolescents or children and adolescents won't eliminate these diseases, but there are opportunities for reducing transmission in unprotected age groups by targeting vaccination of adolescents. So the who of who gets meningococcal disease and pertussis is actually very similar, but reporting practices are very different. For meningococcal disease, cases present acutely ill to emergency rooms. Doctors recognize the severity of meningococcal disease and order reliable diagnostic tests. Therefore, almost all cases of meningococcal disease are reported to health departments. So there are many barriers in the same series of recognition for pertussis. A coughing adolescent may not even present to the clinician or may be coughing for weeks before presenting. A clinician would then have to think of pertussis among the many causes of cough illness. And even if the clinician suspects pertussis, reliable diagnostic tests may not be available or may be difficult to interpret. Finally, if the case is reported to the health department often needs to follow up with the case, ensure that the case actually was coughing for 2 weeks, and confirm the diagnosis. So now we're going to talk a little bit about transmission. Although transmission in cases occur in all age groups, adolescents are thought to be a reservoir for meningococcal disease and pertussis. For pertussis, a coughing adolescent has close interactions with groups of adolescents, which can lead to the development of multiple cases and multiple coughing adolescents. For meningococcal disease, on the other hand, multiple asymptomatic carriers interact in groups of adolescents. They may transmit the organism to a susceptible adolescent, causing disease. These differences in transmission will be important when we talk later about how to control these diseases with vaccine and chemoprophylaxis. So in summary, pertussis and meningococcal disease are both endemic diseases. Cases occur in all age groups with higher rates of disease among infants and adolescents. However, the very different clinical case presentation of these diseases can lead to different recognition and reporting patterns. So now I'm going to talk about the vaccines we use to prevent these diseases in adolescents. Meningococcal conjugate vaccine protects against serogroup A, C, Y, and W disease. Serogroup C and Y's disease cause about 75% of cases of meningococcal disease among adolescents. The carrier protein used for this vaccine is diphtheria toxoid, which is important for the reasons we'll discuss later. There is an additional, so meningococcal disease, MCV4 is conjugated to 48 micrograms of diphtheria toxoid. There is potential licensure of an additional meningococcal conjugate vaccine that's actually conjugated to CREM. This vaccine is under FDA licensure and may be licensed as early as this summer. So we'll have two vaccines on the market. This vaccine would have the same age indications and the same recommendations for use as the currently available vaccine. So there are two vaccines, licensed vaccines for Tdap. Each looks like the DTaP vaccine that the manufacturer makes. So we have acellular pertussis antigens, which are the same as the antigens, but in lower quantity. For example, Boostrix is similar to Infanrix and has three pertussis antigens, and Adacel is similar to Dapticel, which has five pertussis antigens. It has the addition of two Fimbriae antigens. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about how these vaccines were licensed. These vaccines were not licensed on effectiveness data. They were both compared to licensed vaccines for each disease. For example, MCV4 was licensed based on non-inferiority to meningococcal polysaccharide vaccine. Seroresponse was defined as a four-fold rise in serum bacterial antibody activity. As you can see, the proportion of seroresponders for MCV4 was actually similar to meningococcal polysaccharide vaccine. Only 82% responded to serogroup Y and 92% to serogroup C. So clinical effectiveness studies of polysaccharide vaccine suggests it's about 85% effective for serogroup C. There are presumed advantages of conjugate vaccines, including it induces a T-cell dependent response, which should produce immunity of longer duration and induce immunologic memory. So when people are exposed to meningococcal antigen, they'll boost their response more readily than they would if they were given a polysaccharide vaccine. So meningococcal vaccines should last longer, provide a longer duration of protection than meningococcal polysaccharide vaccine and should protect through adolescence. However, at this point, we really don't have any data to prove this, and we haven't seen coverage high enough to evaluate whether or not this vaccine can have any sort of impact on herd immunity and protect against acquisition of carriage. So for Tdap, pertussis efficacy was inferred using a serologic bridge. Immune responses in adolescents to pertussis were compared to immune responses in infants after three doses of DTaP during acellular pertussis efficacy trials. So if you look at these acellular pertussis efficacy trials, there were some for Infanrix and some for Dapticel, and these efficacy trials showed approximately vaccine effectiveness of 85%. Specifically, the Infanrix had an 89% efficacy and Dapticel had 85% efficacy. There is one single pertussis efficacy trial done in the United States using an acellular pertussis-only vaccine, with the components of this vaccine were similar to Boostrix. So this study estimated a vaccine effectiveness of 92%, and this was a study done in both adolescents and adults. But as you can see, the confidence intervals for the study were very wide, and the estimate was made only on one case in the vaccinated group and on nine cases in the unvaccinated group. So we're lacking a known protective antibody level for both diseases. They're clearly effective vaccines, but they're not 100% effective, and they're more likely to be somewhere between 85 and 90% effective. So most importantly, we have a lot to learn about both of these vaccines, such as their ability to reduce transmission to unvaccinated groups and to understand how long they'll protect. So we're going to shift gears now to discuss the ACIP recommendations for these vaccines. The recommendations for these vaccines are actually very simple. All adolescents 11 to 18 years old should receive one dose of Tdap and one dose of MCV4. But if it were this simple, your job would be much easier, and it's not. So the fun comes in the details, and this is where the ACIP recommendations are as not as simple as we would like. There are several situations where we're required to evaluate the risks and benefits of vaccination. For Tdap in particular, we don't have a lot of data about the real risk or the benefit. And fortunately for MCV4, we're gathering more evidence to quantify the risk. So I'll talk about each of these in a little bit of detail. The first issue is the interval between the last dose of TD and Tdap. There's a recommended 5-year interval between TD and Tdap for adolescents to reduce the risk of local and systemic reactions. There's a theoretical risk of receiving multiple doses of tetanus and diphtheria toxoids, and remember, MCV4 contains a large dose of diphtheria toxoid. The DTaP in infants can produce increased reactogenicity with multiple doses of that vaccine. So the recommendations are that shorter intervals for the interval between TD and Tdap may be used if the benefit outweighs the risk of vaccination. So that's interpreted by a lot of you guys to say that if there's a pertussis outbreak and somebody is really being exposed to pertussis multiple times in the setting of school, it's probably more beneficial to offer a dose of Tdap even if the person has received TD in the last 5 years. But it's important to remind those individuals that there may be an increased risk of reactogenicity. There is data emerging to support the fact that this reactogenicity may not be as significant as the theoretical risk, but that data will really be about another year before we know for sure. So the second issue is Tdap and giving Tdap during pregnancy. So we don't have any data on the safety or effectiveness of vaccinating a pregnant woman, but we do want to protect young infants from pertussis. Mothers are often the source of pertussis for these infants. So this is one of the rare instances where ACIP and AAP recommendations are not harmonized. ACIP does not recommend vaccination of pregnant women. AAP recommends pregnant adolescents be given the same consideration for Tdap as non-pregnant adolescents and recommends vaccination in the second or third trimester. So this is another situation where AAP looked at the risk and benefit of vaccinating during pregnancy and felt like the risk of pertussis among adolescents is higher, and therefore there's a higher risk of transmitting pertussis to those infants, and they made that recommendation. ACIP didn't feel there was enough data on the safety of, or effectiveness of pertussis vaccination of pregnant women to make that recommendation. So the good news is with Menactra, we are gathering more evidence to suggest the risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome is actually extremely low after vaccination. There have been 33 cases of GBS reported through the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System since licensure of MCV4. When you compare these rates of GBS to hospital discharge data, it suggests that there's no increase in risk in 11 to 19-year-olds, but there may be a small increase in risk among 15 to 19-year-olds. So investigators in the Immunization Safety Office have also been looking at the vaccine safety data link. And the data from this study is also very encouraging. There have been over 600,000 doses given to people in the Vaccine Safety Data Link, which is a large managed care database that follows and tracks vaccines and events that occur after vaccines very closely. And there's only been one case of GBS that's pending confirmation right now. There have been 5 previously identified cases of GBS that were determined not to be vaccine related or not to actually be GBS. Most of the time, this was in persons who had a diagnosis of GBS prior to receiving vaccine, and that diagnosis remained with them over time. So we either have 0 or 1 cases of GBS with 600,000 doses given. Every case of GBS has recovered that have been reported, and there have been no deaths. So we may see an excess of one case of GBS for every 1 to 2 million doses of vaccine given, but this is actually a smaller risk than the risk of meningococcal disease, which is about 3 per million adolescents, and where the case fatality rate is 10 to 15%. So in summary, all adolescents 11 to 18 years old should receive a dose of Tdap and MCV4, preferably at the 11 or 12 year old vaccine visit, and more data on the safety and interval, safety in special situations such as pregnancy and intervals is emerging, and we should see some of this data in the next couple of years and be able to better define the risk benefit. The next steps in MCV4 and Tdap use is how we put disease control into practice now that we have these vaccines available. This slide shows coverage levels among 13 to 17 year olds in the fall of 2007. Coverage with TD or Tdap was over 70%, while coverage with MCV4 was around 32%. We see similar coverage in all age groups, which is great. It means that providers are vaccinating all adolescents, even outside that 11 to 12 year old visit. I'm using TD Tdap coverage here rather than only Tdap coverage because I think that's the what we can get with MCV4 coverage with just a couple of more years and without a lot of more work. However, I think there are additional barriers to MCV4, such as cost, that need to be addressed before we can really attain this 75% coverage level. But the real challenge in vaccinating adolescents is going to be getting from this 75% coverage level to this 95% coverage level. And I'm going to show you here what this does to outbreak situations. So coverage actually has a lot to do with how we prevent disease. First of all, if we can get coverage up over 90%, we hopefully will see a lot fewer outbreaks of these diseases and a lot fewer outbreaks to manage. But for now, every outbreak is an opportunity to increase vaccination coverage. So outbreaks are perpetuated by susceptible groups. Going into the calculation of a susceptible group is vaccine effectiveness and coverage. We can't change the vaccine effectiveness estimate, but we can change coverage. And look what happens. If we increase our coverage from 75% to 95%, we reduce our susceptible population by half. So this isn't even taking into account the possible effects of herd immunity reducing transmission if coverage levels are this high. For now, since response to vaccine takes 7 to 14 days, vaccination during an outbreak can't replace chemoprophylaxis of close contacts for either disease. However, vaccinating in the setting of an outbreak may interrupt transmission and may reduce the length of an outbreak. So one of the big questions we hear a lot is, do we need to give chemoprophylaxis to persons who are vaccinated prior to being exposed to either of these diseases? For meningococcal disease, this isn't as big of a deal. Prophylaxis is often given before you have the serogroup information. And because we know this vaccine isn't 100% effective and the disease is so serious, most individuals do want to be prophylaxed after being exposed to meningococcal disease. For pertussis, adolescents are often exposed multiple times during outbreaks, and there's a longer exposure period, which produces many, many more close contacts. So being able to say vaccinated persons do not need prophylaxis would reduce the workload of contact investigations drastically. Unfortunately, we don't yet have data to support this, and there's an active, tomorrow there's gonna be an outbreak, pertussis outbreak management session where we're gonna talk about this in more detail. But for right now, we still have to offer prophylaxis to vaccinated persons who are exposed to pertussis. So this question we're also hearing more and more every day, and the question is, will we have to revaccinate with Tdap and or MCV4? So the short answer is yes, but the who and the when is unknown, and right now both of these vaccines are licensed only for a single time use. The duration of protection for both of these vaccines is unknown, but we know pertussis vaccine immunity wanes, so we know eventually there will probably need to be another dose of Tdap. We also have evidence from the United Kingdom to suggest that memory response, which is what conjugate vaccines are so good at creating, may not be enough to protect against meningococcal disease. So we have to maintain high antibody levels in addition to having that conjugate boostability response. So the disease risk for both of these diseases continues throughout life. preteen girls will become mothers, hopefully not in adolescence, and preteens will also hopefully become college freshmen. So we need to make sure these groups are fully protected, and we don't yet have enough data to know if a child vaccinated at 11 will maintain protection through these periods of risk for him, herself or herself, or to a mother's child. So finally, both pertussis and meningococcal disease are endemic with transmission among adolescents, but they have very different disease patterns. Susceptible populations remain and will remain. However, increasing vaccination coverage rates will reduce disease in the target population and may increase herd immunity across all age groups, including high-risk infants. And finally, the safety and effectiveness data are emerging and may help us refine our recommendations in the future, such as the recommendations for intervals and revaccination. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Amanda. I know Amanda tried to anticipate some of the questions, but I'm sure there will be more, and we have time for a couple of questions from the audience.
Good morning. Your presentation was very interesting. Could you comment on the benefit and risk of using the shorter two-year interval spacing between TD and Tdap and the benefit and risk of that? The reason we're in Florida, I'm from Florida, and we just initiated implemented a Tdap requirement at seventh grade where we previously had a TD recommendation. And our concern is that if we go to our feedback from our school nurses and our health department nurses are that if we try to track, we'll have to give them a medical exemption for those that don't meet that criteria, and that means that they will track seventh graders through 12th grade, and they may graduate high school without us being able to capture that group. So I think we're leaning towards going with the two-year interval, but if you'd like to comment on the benefit and risk, I'd appreciate it.
So I think the benefit is easy to comment on. Certainly giving Tdap at a shorter interval will provide protection against pertussis, regardless of when they received the TD. So it's the risk that we really are gathering evidence to look at more closely. There have been some studies in Canada that suggest that a two-year interval is okay between TD and Tdap. The difference between those studies is that those kids did not get the meningococcal conjugate vaccine at the same time. So the reason why we're a little bit more cautious with this recommended five-year interval, but you can go down to as close as 2 years, is because they're also getting diphtheria toxoid from MCV4. There are studies that are being done in adults, and there's one study that was done in New Hampshire after a large pertussis vaccination in a hospital that showed that in adults, the interval between TD and Tdap did not increase reactogenicity. So the intervals were as close as 6 months, and there were not increased increased rates of swelling or pain. But those are really the things that we're looking at are really whether or not it causes increased redness, swelling, arm pain, and most of those adverse reactions are going to go away in a couple of days anyway. So I think as long as you sort of take that into account, intervals shorter than 5 years can certainly be used. Does that help?
I'm Linda Ory from Creighton University in Omaha, and I'd like to comment on that because we just had one of our pharmacy students, a P1 who's already working in a pharmacy, so he has regular contact with the public, who was not vaccinated. He was one of only two students in his class because we have a TDAP mandate. And the reason why he was not vaccinated is because the vaccinators were quite rigid about the two-year rule. He did contract pertussis. And I guess my comment about it is I interpret at least the expert Q&A information from the CDC trainers to say that there is no minimal interval and that really the obligation of vaccinators is to communicate to the patient the benefits and the risks, and then the choice should be up to the patient to decide. So this student couldn't work, was excluded from class, and I think if given the choice, probably would have accepted the risk of a local reaction. So I think we really have to rethink our policies, because their policy was, and it was easier to do it that way, 2 years we don't give it. But there are ramifications to that.
Right. So I think, you know, you're hitting on a point that has caused probably the most confusion of these Tdap recommendations. And it's true that in the ACIP recommendations, we do not say that intervals less than 2 years cannot be used. We do sort of use that language about evaluating the risk and benefits, but we did say that there's data to suggest that a 2-year interval is safe. And I think that language has caused a lot of people to have these rules where you cannot be vaccinated less than 2 years. So the ACIP working group is meeting in the next couple of months, and hopefully these recommendations will be revised and made more clear in the next year. I also sort of hope these issues go away over time, as mostly Tdap is being used and TD sort of gets, you know, most people will have not been vaccinated with TD in the last 5 years. But I totally understand that that's been a huge problem.
If I can just make one other comment, because we've really been lucky at our school. We've had an outbreak of pertussis too 2 years ago that we actually did a survey about this last summer that we're hoping to get information out. But another of our experiences was in dealing with that outbreak, and this is amongst a group of students who continually have patient contact on a regular basis, there was much more emphasis given to chemoprophylaxis. And in talking with students and in actual survey of students, many of them got the message that it was chemoprophylaxis that they should concentrate on and very little emphasis on vaccination. So that indeed we really had to work on our mandate. We had just instituted the mandate when the outbreak occurred. So we were then in that year working on that mandate, but it really would have helped in the outbreak conditions if the public health recommendations had been much more clear that whether or not you get chemoprophylaxis, you need to be vaccinated.
Right. And I think, you know, we're working also on making that language clear. I mean, every outbreak is an opportunity to vaccinate, and those individuals may still need chemoprophylaxis, but actually the more, you're giving much more protection over the long term by vaccinating those individuals.